Yeah, it's really a sign of dedication when you show up for a lecture at 9:30 in the morning, so I appreciate it. I want to thank the colleagues and friends who put together this exciting program for inviting me to take part in it. I'm deeply honored and delighted to be here. I would like to begin my presentation by reading a few lines of poetry from Nazım Hikmet, one of the greatest poets Turkey has ever known. I hope you will indulge me the pleasure of reading to you in the poem's original language. Şehir uzakta, genç adam ayakta. Akıyor şehirden geçen nehir, genç adamın ayakları dibinden. Genç adam piposunu çıkarıyor cebinden, aranıyor kibriti. Bakıyor akarsuya, düşünüyor Herakliti. Düşünüyor büyük hakim Herakliti, genç adam. Kim bilir, belki böyle bir akşam, böyle bir akşam Heraklit alnını yeşil gözlü zeytinliklerde akan suya eğdi ve dedi, her şey değişip akmada, bu hal beni hayran bırakmada. Heraklit, Heraklit ne akıştır bu, ne akıştır ki bu dalgalarında, dağlıdır alnı en mukaddes putun, kızgın demir damgasıyla sükutun. Gebedir her sükut bir yükselişe, ne mümkün karşı koymak bu köpürmüş gelişe. Now, it's impossible to do justice to Hikmet's beautiful poetry in translation, and I will not even pretend that my attempt will be the most skillful. Nonetheless, I will translate the last two lines into English to set the tone for my paper, lines which describe a young revolutionary conversing with the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, contemplating the flow of water. Gebedir her sükut bir yükselişe, ne mümkün karşı koymak bu köpürmüş gelişe. Something like, every silence is pregnant with a rising. How impossible it is to arrest this frothed coming. I begin my paper with Nazım Hikmet because its title, Why Did Bu Azizi Burn Himself?, is an allusion to his great poem, Why Did Benerji Kill Himself?, written in 1932. With Mayakovskian rhythm and imagery characteristic of Hikmet's poetry, this poem brings to life the anti-colonial and anti-capitalist struggle of the masses in Calcutta through the personal history of Benerji, a fictional character representing a leading communist militant in India's struggle for liberation. Benerji commits suicide after being catapulted to the leadership of the movement in his old age, upon release from years of imprisonment. The climactic ending of the poem, which imparts the poem its name, provides a lucid account of Benerji's reasons for ending his own life. In Hikmet's rendition, which turns out to be a firm statement against those who condemn the sacrifice of life, Benerji's self-killing is not merely understandable, but even laudable. Accordingly, it was Benerji's transparent self-knowledge, his awareness of his physical weakness and failing judgment, that made him realize that his contribution to the struggle might hinder the revolutionary cause rather than lead it to success. In keeping with this realization, Benerji kills himself not out of despair, but as a willing renunciation in order to eliminate the barriers in front of the future of the movement, a renunciation of a subjective existence in order to strengthen the objective conditions of revolution. Benerji explains, the role of the individual in history is obvious. He cannot change the direction of its flow. He can only accelerate its rhythm or slow it down. That's all. The thing called the individual in history has impact on quantity, not quality. End of quote. Fearing that an insistence on assuming the leadership role assigned to him by the masses may be the equivalent of an unwitting betrayal of the movement, even when the damage would only be quantitative and not qualitative, Benerji declares his decision to end his life. His boundless commitment to the revolutionary cause and his optimistic belief in the certainty of its success for determining the future of India thus drive him not merely to devote all his life to the struggle, but also to eliminate it with his own hands when he understands his existence to have become an impediment to the progress of history. Inspired, without a doubt, by the Marxian reading of the Hegelian dialectic. Hikmet's poem ends with a renewed commitment to the struggle and a eulogy for Benerji, reversing the conventional imprecation of those who kill themselves in struggle as individuals who cannot and should not be lamented. Now, the politically sophisticated, sacrificial consciousness of the communist militant Benerji, marked by devotion to the revolutionary cause and the exaltation of the movement of the masses over and above the life of the individual, is a far cry from that of Mohamed Bouazizi, the 26-year-old itinerant fruit vendor whose self-immolation triggered the mass protests and popular uprising in Tunisia that swept away the recalcitrant regime, the authoritarian regime of Ben Ali. Bouazizi, it will be remembered, set himself ablaze in front of a government building in the city of Sidi Bouzid on December 17, 2010. After an encounter with the local officials in which his fruit cart, along with the electronic scale worth several months of his income, was confiscated by officials who attempted to extract a bribe for letting him keep his spot on the street. In the altercation, he was also allegedly slapped by a female official who was in charge and beaten by her colleagues, which added insult to injury. Having lost all of his means to make a living and being physically harassed and humiliated, Bouazizi went to the municipality and then to the governor's office to explain his situation and ask for redress. Bouazizi carried out his self-immolation after being refused time with the higher officials. While he remained hospitalized for severe burns in the last 2 weeks of his life, the local uprising, instigated by the news of his self-immolation, had already gripped the whole country. The heavy crackdown of security forces on the protesters and the news of Bouazizi's death on January 4, 2011, became further catalysts for the mobilization of the Tunisian people. At the time Ben Ali fled the country, protests had already spilled to Egypt, and their reverberations soon reached Libya, Morocco, Yemen, Bahrain, Jordan, and Syria. Many commentators have speculated about Bouazizi's experience, why he acted the way he did. Perhaps it was his wounded male pride due to the slap from the female official. Perhaps it was anger, perhaps desperation that pushed him over the edge. Though we know more about the consciousness of the fictional Benerji in Nazım Hikmet's poem than we do about the inner turmoil that must have pushed Bouazizi to bring his life to a painful end by fire, there is much to learn from one in understanding the other. Indeed, if Benerji's act signifies the hope he invests in the movement of history, Bouazizi's act becomes the heartbreaking signpost of individual despair in the very possibility of change. Benerji's act is carried out in relation to a popular movement he saw on his side, his comrades and friends, whereas Bouazizi's act is carried out in relation to his enemy, the authoritarian state, and its petty local functionaries. If Benerji's self-killing is carried out as a sacrifice of the individual's life to the collective, only through which the individual has a meaningful existence, Bouazizi's self-killing is a testament to the absence of a collective movement and the helpless solitude experienced by the individual before the existing order, which now appears to have become some kind of fate. So the dramatic difference and distance between these two acts of self-killing, two fatal acts, sets the stage for the exploration I want to undertake about the connection between fate, fatality, and politics. Let me first Excuse me. Let me first try to situate Bouazizi's self-immolation as part of an emergent repertoire of fatal political action, which is distinct from conventional forms of protest. Self-immolation is a modality of political action whose technique is self-destruction. Some scholars call this suicide protest, but I find myself opposed to this label because of the crypto-normative connotations of suicide and its individualizing and depoliticizing or politically neutralizing function. Self-destruction can have different modalities. Self-mutilation, hunger strikes, especially fasts onto death, self-hanging, as well as more aggressive forms such as suicide attacks. We can view these acts in a continuum from less fatal to more, from more defensive to more aggressive, from slower to faster. Among this repertoire, self-immolations stand out by the high likelihood of death, the instantaneous performance, the difficulty of reversing its effects, even when the action might be interrupted, and the mainly self-directed violence, self-directed scope of its violence. This repertoire stamps a distinct current of radical politics in our contemporary conjuncture, with its increasing prevalence and frequency, despite its overall invisibility. The question is, why is it not so visible? Well, because the performers of these acts are often in the margins of the political, with little social, economic, cultural, and epistemic standing, as a result of which they rarely make the news. Especially those self-immolations that take place behind the walls of the prison, the immigration detention centers, and the refugee camps, they're not reported accurately or not reported at all. The difficulties of documentation are often compounded by censorship and the interest of often authoritarian regimes to reframe these actions as individual suicides. Added to that are problems of media coverage and dissemination. Most of these acts, even when they are reported, simply become statistics. Combined with the relative paucity of studies, of scholarly studies focusing on these forms of resistance, it's very difficult to construct an exhaustive history of self-immolations. Rather, and perhaps more fittingly, with the nature of these acts, what we have is a history in fragments. Even so, we can observe a definitive proliferation, both numerically and geographically, in the last few decades, and a wide variety of political issues that are expressed through these acts. Some of these issues include, and you will recall some of the very famous self-immolations, protesting the repression of Buddhism in South Vietnam, protesting the war in Vietnam, the invasion of Czechoslovakia, the Nigerian Civil War, the authoritarianism of the Soviet Union, prison conditions in Turkey, job quotas for governmental posts in India, the oppression of civil rights in South Korea, Iran, Tibet, China, Turkey, the treatment of immigrants in Australia and the UK, and the list goes on. At least 24 self-immolations have taken place, for example, in the 1990s in Germany, mainly by Kurdish militants. The stunning range of political issues that are raised by self-immolations suggests that we are faced with a truly global phenomenon. Even while the individuals who are performing these acts remain dispersed, their grievances unconnected, and the reverberations of their actions largely local, if any at all. This fatal repertoire defies any easy generalizations. However, I would like to highlight three distinctive qualities of self-immolations that underline their specificity vis-a-vis more conventional forms of protest. First of all, a distinguishing facet of this form of protest is its reliance on the body as the vessel of one's political intervention. According to Hamid Dabashi, in the age, and I quote, in the age of globalized capital and aterritorial empires, bodies have emerged as the singular site of resistance to power, end of quote. This is because Dabashi contends bodies are the only means left to individuals whose lives are systematically reduced to biology by the existing world order, especially marked by the state of exception that has become the rule. This is his term. The biopolitical management and control of bodies meets resistance from the points of its application. So individuals push back against power with their bodies, which have become sites of political contestation. In this light, Didier Fassin has suggested that Bouazizi's body is a site that brings together both, and I quote, the structural and the political violence of the state and the ultimate resistance of the individual, end of quote. However, I think it would be a mistake to reduce this political intervention to corporeality alone. This is because the deployment of the body in self-immolations, in contrast to more conventional forms of protest that are not life-threatening, obliterates the instrumentality of the body as a simple means to advance specific demands. By pushing instrumentality to its extremity and eventual annulment, the political intervention involved in the destruction of the very means to a political end suggests that the meaning of the body is always already attached to a metaphysical commentary on the meaning of life and existence. In this sense, the self-destructive act not only uses the body as an instrument, but redefines it as the material congealment of an existential statement. By destroying the body, this act asserts the claim that a life without justice is not worth living. The preference for a dignified exit, a dignified death, in place of a life that is reduced to a minimal biological existence, stands in stark contrast to what Giorgio Agamben calls bare life, as the condition that signifies the vulnerability and dispoliticization of life produced by the biopolitical operation of sovereign power. I want to mark my strong objection to Agamben here, whose work ignores the individuals who go to great lengths to refuse being defined from the perspective of power and find ways, however dismal, to reclaim a definition of life that is always already political, by virtue of its relation to dignity and justice. It is therefore the political meaning of life that is asserted as a weapon of struggle that underlies the performance of self-immolation. Hence, while self-immolations are marked by the use of the body, this use is guided and made meaningful by the weaponization of life. A second distinguishing feature of self-immolations is that they constitute a potent symbolic expression of the violence experienced in the current political and social order. On the one hand, they make visible the invisible structural violence experienced every day in a concrete material form and put it on display for the public at large through an act of repetition. This repetition not only magnifies the injustice and indignity suffered by the individuals who perform self-immolations, but also enables others who suffer similar situations to recognize themselves in that performance. On the other hand, the gesture of repetition that makes structural violence visible to those affected by it does so by redirecting the violence upon the self. What is revealed in this redirection is the oscillation of violence from the destructive function that culminates in the disappearance of the subject through self-destruction to the constructive or more productive function, which asserts the political subjectivity of those who are consumed or otherwise wounded by the structural violence thus made visible. The self-directed violence becomes a form of political expression through which suppressed subjectivities are asserted only at the moment of their visible self-destruction. In this sense, self-immolations constitute a form of embodied critique. They call attention to particular circumstances, grievances, and demands with the goal of inspiring others to action. Through this critique, they assert the political existence of subjects whose position of marginality vis-à-vis the central structures of power, their lack of access to official mechanisms of redress, and lack of public standing in the conventional spheres of political debate have hitherto silenced their voice. The third characteristic of self-immolations concerns the specificity of the resistance they entail. Instead of an appeal to authorities that invites, or at the very least allows, negotiation and accommodation, and rather than as an instrument for increasing leverage or pressure for a particular demand, self-immolations tend to mark an end, a point of no return. As a result, perhaps a more accurate way of interpreting these acts is to view them as manifestations of an absolute refusal of domination rather than an ordinary act of resistance. In this sense, Bouazizi's individual refusal was transformed into a general one through the slogan of Dégage that became the popular outcry in Tunisia. On the one hand, this refusal points to the suffocation of the individual before the apparatuses of domination that are increasingly total and totalizing, with their aspiration to govern all aspects of life in a way that greatly limits, if not altogether eliminates, individual agency. On the other hand, the same refusal is a spontaneous expression of rage that entails the politicization of life to the fullest degree through its weaponization. In other words, the contradictory poles of the void of agency produced by existing circumstances and the plenitude of agency that arises from frustration and rage with the circumstances conjoin to push individuals toward the radical rejection of the existing order to having no part in it. According to Benjamin, man is, and I quote, impelled by anger to the most visible outbursts of violence that is not related as a means to a preconceived end. It is not a means, but a manifestation, end of quote. Such a manifestation of violence, an expressive, non-mediate violence, marks an aporetic duality, calling for justice precisely at the same time as underscoring the impossibility of its realization under the existing conditions. Understanding this aporia is crucial for an accurate evaluation of self-immolations as a form of refusal that is determined both by the extreme lack of agency and its extremely politicized exercise. Such a contradiction casts the existing order as a kind of fate that individuals are forced to accept, even while it provokes them to challenge it by taking the fate of their own lives into their own hands. Self-immolation, then, can be understood as a refusal of the conditions imposed by power, already decided and solidified into law, protected by violence, by a last-ditch attempt to reclaim political agency through violence, a violence that is both a statement of existence, but also the abolition of the agency that performs it in the name of redemption. Having defined self-immolations within a distinct repertoire of fatal politics, which posits a significant link between the lack of agency against structural violence that is perceived as fate and the attempt to refuse it, I now want to turn to explore the connection between agency and fate in the history of political thought. And this brings me to the final part of my paper, in which I try to locate fatal politics in the nexus between fate and politics. Fate, of course, is a concept that commands a long history of its own, with a complex trajectory of differentiated definitions and connotations, delineating a broad and shifting semantic field. This field is constituted by a constellation of concepts which include determination and free will, rationality and providence, necessity and contingency, agency and history. Here I want to draw attention to the polyvalence inscribed in the etymological origins of the concept of fate. Fate is derived from the Latin fata. The word means both speak, utterance, and the thing spoken by the gods. A prophetic declaration, an oracle, a prediction about what the future holds, what is ordained or destined. The dual meaning points to the intimate connection between speech and the unalterability of what has been spoken. Fatalism, then, points to the belief in the impossibility of upending what has already been spoken. But the etymology of fate is further revealing. The verb to fate means not only to be destined, but also to destroy. In the ancient Greek context, fate often implied the divine declaration of what must fall to one's lot, usually understood as adversity, misfortune, death, destruction, ruin. The negative connotations of fate as bad fortune and its inescapability are connected with the word fatal, which derives from the Latin fatalis, that is, ordained by fate, gaining the connotation of causing death. The intimate connection between fortune and destruction, between destiny and death, is thus etched into the concept of fate. The tragic heroes of ancient Greece often fought against a fate they did not want to accept and became subjects in and through that struggle. In ancient mythologies, fates refer to three goddesses who were in charge of human destiny. Tyche, the daughter of Aphrodite and Hermes, was revered as the goddess of fortune or luck, the cause of unexpected events, natural cataclysms, as well as political upheavals. In the Roman personification, the goddess Fortuna controlled chance, embodying contingency in her capriciousness and wielding power over fate, deciding success in life as well as dealing death and destruction. Fate has also played an important role in the interpretation of history, commanding an explanatory force for unexpected turns of luck, great and unforeseen catastrophes and opportunities. Polybius, for example, attributes a crucial role to fortune in his great historical treatise, whose opening remarks define the study of history, and I quote, "There is no more comprehensible and comprehensive teacher of the ability to endure with courage the vicissitudes of fortune than a record of others' catastrophes," end of quote. In the histories of Polybius, references to fortune do important, if at times contradictory, work. On the one hand, fate is understood as chance occurrences and as an explanation of events that cannot be otherwise explained by rational causes, while on the other hand, it is used as a purposeful and meaningful force which aids and vindicates certain outcomes over others who have the necessary virtue to succeed against and sometimes with the help of fate. In Livy's early history of Rome, for example, we find the famous line, "Fortune favors the bold." which penetrates the Renaissance imagination through the Neo-Roman revival that comes after a long interregnum of Christian political theology. When Machiavelli famously picks up the contest between individual agency and fortune and takes its significance to a whole new level, he also displaces the political theological concept of fate or conception of fate, which had largely reconciled the opposing duality within the cosmological pagan understanding of fate as purposeless contingency and purposeful direction by a reference to God's will and omniscience. The monotheistic interpretation of fate enabled, in one breath, to assert that human history had already been preordained without canceling free will, to make the right and pious choices, and to assure that what happened, what appeared contingent and unexplainable, was simply an index of man's imperfect nature and inability to grasp or know divine will. By contrast, in Machiavelli, the transcendent knowledge of God is supplanted by the necessity to study and learn from history, to draw practical lessons from the successes and failures of the past in the face of an unknown future. In Machiavelli's Prince, the struggle with fate in the pursuit of one's political objective becomes the very object of politics. In order to achieve the goal of founding and maintaining a new state, the prince may benefit from fortune, but he may also suffer from it. If he is to succeed, he must have virtù. He must be in tune with the times, but also know how to change. He must inspire fear, but never foster hatred. He must appear, and I quote, merciful, faithful, humane, honest, and religious, and to be so, but also, and I quote again, have a spirit disposed to change as the winds of fortune and variations of things command him, end of quote. Ultimately, he must rely on his own forces or create them if they are found lacking, since, and I quote, without his own arms, no principality is secure. Indeed, it is wholly obliged to fortune, since it does not have the virtue to defend itself in adversity, end of quote. Adversity or misfortune is a continuous threat against which precautions must be taken. If dams and dikes have not been made to contain her, the violent river of fortune will, and I quote, flood the plains, ruin the trees and the buildings, lift earth from this part, drop it in another, end of quote. Arming one's subjects or citizens into a popular militia and gaining their friendship constitute the invention of the people as the self-generating force that can be enlisted in the princely battle against adversity. However, this force, which otherwise lacks a collective will of its own, is beholden to a prince who must impart his will upon the people. What is at stake in each encounter of political virtue with fortune is not only the project of creating and maintaining a national state, but the test of the limits of human agency before the contingency and constraints of history, the uncontrollable and unpredictable element, as well as that part of which is transformed into necessity. In the famous chapter 25 of The Prince, how much fortune can do in human affairs and in what mode it may be opposed, Machiavelli refutes fatalism, even as he acknowledges the great variability of things. In fact, it is on the basis of that great variability that imposing direction upon history might become possible. The contingency of the world implies the possibility of changing it in the direction Machiavelli calls for in the famous exhortation. In this conception, and I quote again, it might be true that fortune is arbiter of half of our actions, but also that she leaves the other half, or close to it, for us to govern, end of quote. Hence, the redeemer of the people, or he who sets up and commands the popular army, will also command its collective fate. I dwell on Machiavelli at length because with Machiavelli, we are really at a threshold of a new political horizon, one in which willful political action is possible without a teleology of history, where history is the human struggle to master fate with the ever-present danger of being undone by it, and where the foundational elements of modern sovereignty, which I think Machiavelli sets forth, in which the constitution of the individuals into a political collectivity through the establishment of relations of command and obedience becomes the precondition of exerting control over people's collective destiny. In other words, Machiavelli prepares the theoretical grounding of the predominant framework of sovereignty in which the battle of human agency with fate will be carried out in modernity. The Hobbesian concept of sovereignty, understood as the command over life and death, systematizes Machiavelli's reflections by lodging Machiavelli's Protean call for a prince to the task of founding and maintaining a state in a seat of power to which people give consensual obedience. Hobbes thereby weaves together the different meanings associated with fate, the attempt to control contingency by constituting a commonwealth, an artificial and peaceful eternity against the ever-present threat of violence and disorder, the allocation to each man what will fall to his lot by law, i.e. the speech of the sovereign as the mortal god, and finally, the dispensation of death and all the lesser punishments in regards to the defiance of the law or the disruption of security. In each sense, the sovereign is substituted in place of God as the ultimate arbiter of fate. But the Hobbesian system comes at a cost. In a radical reversal of Machiavelli's approach to politics, in which all purposeful activity is directed toward utilizing contingency in the service of one's political purpose, and when this is not possible, to minimize the damage of adversity, Hobbes's construction of sovereignty aims to keep under control, if not eliminate altogether, chance occurrences and the fluctuations in politics. Through the concept of sovereignty, signifying the attempt to control fate by a regime that decides and distributes fatality, then the unpredictability of history is married with a teleological purpose of maintaining political order through the modern state. Against the theological conception of fate, Hobbes places the artificial fate of the state, thereby replacing otherworldly redemption with safety in this world. Against the pagan conception of fate, revived by Machiavelli's Fortuna, Hobbes posits the stability of a legal order maintained by the sword. Building on Foucault's interpretation of Machiavelli and the tradition of raison d'etat, insecurity, territory, and population, this move, which even in contradictory or incomplete form, announces the beginning of biopolitical governmentality. Instead of the cosmological political concept of fortune on which Machiavelli relies to address a future that is aleatory and its attendant concept of sovereignty, characterized by keeping the misfortunes external to one's territory, Foucault argues, the art of government is based on techniques of probabilistic calculation and economic administration. Raison d'etat, therefore, concerns, and I quote, no longer the safety of the prince and his territory, but the security of the population, and consequently of those who govern it, end of quote. The problem of government, according to Foucault, is, and I quote again, simply a matter of maximizing the positive elements for which one provides the best possible circulation and of minimizing what is risky and inconvenient, like theft and disease, while knowing that they will never be completely suppressed. End of quote. Such an art is turned to the future and embraces the contingent, understood not as Machiavellian political opportunity or adversity, nor as Hobbesian existential threat, but as probabilistic values in a series that will have to be regulated within multivalent and transformable networks, frameworks. In this framework, the art of government works by separating the positive and negative elements of a situation, putting them into motion, managing their circulation, and thereby containing their impact without eliminating those elements or preventing them from occurring. Pursuing this line, I want to sharpen Foucault's point. I would say governmentality is not just the instrumental and statistical regulation of chance, it is the immanentization of fate. It is the rendering imminent of fate. As a result, instead of a prince in continuous struggle with fate for preserving his territory in a relationship of exteriority, we thus arrive at a certain permanence of the state that arises from and is reproduced by the management of fate subsumed to governmental techniques deployed by the state. The state then becomes fate. It is inscribed within a temporally indefinite horizon with no other purpose than its self-reproduction. Within the domain of governmentality, the adversity of fortune becomes the occasion for the intervention of the state, either by coup d'etat or by policing, in order to manage unexpected disorders and dangers that cannot be regulated by the laws to further render fate imminent to the probabilistic calculation of an administrative apparatus. The governmental state is, at the same time, a police state. After all, it is Foucault who says that the police is the permanent coup d'etat. Perhaps the best example of such violence directed at, and I quote, the disturbers of the public peace and of the state, that's the quote, is instantiated in the Jacobin necessity to slay the enemies of the revolution in order to secure the fate of the revolution and to establish the virtuous purity of the Commonwealth by combining the sovereign right to take life or let live, or the decision of fatality, with the management of emergency through an involuted art of government applied by the state to the state for its self-protection and reproduction. The Enlightenment optimism regarding the potentiality of human agency before fate, which manifests itself as the attempt to internalize contingency, thereby reinforces and merges with the violent apparatus of sovereignty in the service of the people, now defined as a collective subject, which is self-instituting and self-governing, in other words, the nation as a community of fate. It is within this modern paradigm of the state and biopolitical management that we find the fate-deciding function of Hobbes's sovereign becoming biologized, racialized, and hierarchicalized. In other words, instead of drawing a simple line between what must live and what must die, we find a distribution of the death function through the differential exposure of different populations to the risk of death. The transformation of fate from the unpredictability of history into a matter of probabilistic calculation by way of the increasing prominence of the coup d'etat within techniques of government as a permanent state of emergency translates into the uneven distribution of fatality across populations. In colonial spaces and occupied territories, or under what Membe calls terror formations, the spatial actualizations of government as a permanent coup d'etat, whole populations are rendered disposable, while under liberal democratic governments, the dispensable parts of the population, those that are people of color, the homeless, unemployed, illiterate, disabled, etc., emerge more forcefully in the wake of exceptional events or disasters. Riding on the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in the United States, Henry Giroux points out that the way in which the state dealt with the contingency of disaster revealed how, and I quote, entire populations are now considered disposable, an unnecessary burden on state coffers, and consigned to fend for themselves, end of quote. However, the unequal distribution of fatality attendant to the imminentization of fate, which produces the existence of a population always just a little bit closer to death than the rest, an invisible surplus population that can no longer be subsumed into the welfare apparatuses of the state, but is ever more criminalized, punished, or left to die, it also leads to its own forms of resistance. And here we meet necro-resistance again, the resort to self-destruction as an embodied critique and a refusal of domination, an assertion of agency at the moment of its abnegation. Necro-resistance can now be interpreted as the attempt to reclaim agency over fate through fatal action. Under conditions of necropower, argues Membe, and I quote, the lines between resistance and suicide, sacrifice and redemption, martyrdom and freedom are blurred, end of quote. In societies where the state endeavors to turn fate into the statistical management of contingency by a permanent coup, and in the process hierarchizes populations, unequally distributing their exposure to danger and rendering some superfluous, thereby reducing justice to an imminent outcome of the apparatus of domination, necro-resistance erupts as an appeal to transcendent justice as a last attempt to interrupt fate, reaching for the emergency brake on the train of history, as Benjamin so poignantly described revolution. This, I think, is what Bouazizi does. From this perspective, the contrast between Bouazizi and Benerji, with which I began this presentation, becomes more meaningful. In Nazım Hikmet's poem, it is the movement of the masses that culminates in Benerji's suicide, who comes to perceive his life as the obstacle in front of the progress of freedom and justice. Bouazizi turns the poem on its head. It is his singular death that is culminated in the movement of the masses, which has once again set into motion the struggle for freedom and justice. But perhaps because of Bouazizi, the same contrast is no longer as stark. With his self-immolation, Bouazizi has reopened the question of a philosophy of history, the meaning of fate, and the role of individual agency within it. The poem of Nazım Hikmet has etched the character of Benerji into literary memory by its celebration of the revolutionary action of the masses, its certitude in the ultimate victory of the struggle for liberation, and its subsumption of the individual into the movement of history. By contrast, it was Bouazizi's fatal action which served as an injunction to take action in order to reclaim a dignified life before the fatalism of the present. If Bouazizi was successful as a catalyst that then moved millions of people into action, it was because the desire to refuse domination, to reject the status of disposability, and to change the conditions of existence were already there, even though the collective forms of struggle to realize this desire were lacking. Bouazizi reminded us of that desire, and we're more hopeful before history thanks to him. Let us recall Hikmet's lines. Every silence is pregnant with a rising. How impossible it is to arrest this frothed coming. But individuals deserve their own poems. Bouazizi's poem awaits being written, but it cannot be written without reference to the weaponization of life that challenges fate, or the masses who have followed Bouazizi's injunction to change it. The revolutionary movement he set into motion, as Marx once remarked, cannot create its poetry from the past, but only from the future. Thank you.